Our last word in business today comes from the folks at Woot.com. The quirky e-commerce website sells one item a day, often some heavily discounted electronic gadget. Woot's customer service consists of telling people to consult a magic 8-ball. Still, more than 2 million people have signed up for the site. They're drawn, perhaps, to its humorous commentaries and its invitation to do some impulse buying. Yesterday, Woot said it had been acquired by Amazon. To help process the change in corporate status, Woot workers came up with this bit of merger rap.
So you can labor every day until you're tired and old, or wait for Amazon to call, and when they do, you say, sold!
That's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Monte.
By Amazon, we used to say, we're from Woot, and fools would go, who? But now we're hooking up with the Notorious Crew. It's like the second greatest rock and roll swindle, but this time we're all getting refurbished Kindles. From now on, S3's the image host we're gonna use. From here out, Zappos is where we buy all our shoes. Ain't gonna work at crappy IKEA desks anymore. We're getting Amazon desks. It's like a salvage door.
That's true. Everybody at Amazon works on a door for some reason. It's like a thing. Yeah, but anyway.
It's true, we got acquired by Amazon. That's right, we got acquired by Amazon.
The Last Airbender is a film born under a bad sign. First, there's the name. It was originally called Avatar, The Last Airbender, but Avatar as a film title was already taken. Then there's the timing. It's opening in theaters this same week as the new Twilight movie. Film critic Kenneth Turan surveys the damage.
The best films for kids have always had something for adults in them. That was true when The Black Stallion came out 30 years ago, and when Toy Story 3 came out last month. The problem with The Last Airbender is that it's pegged almost exclusively to the small fry state of mind of the original Nickelodeon series. The film takes us to a self-contained mythic universe inhabited by four tribal peoples: the Air Nomads, the Water Tribe, the Earth Kingdom, and the Fire Nation. Each group has chosen people called benders who can, yes, bend their particular element to their will. A shaman called an avatar keeps these four tribes in harmony, but he's been gone for 100 years, and war has broken out in his absence. The film gets going when the young avatar, who's been trapped in an iceberg, is rescued by a brother and sister. As the avatar tries to recover his powers, the siblings try to protect him from the evil all around.
What is this?
Anyway, Fire Nation is here.
The Last Airbender retains the Asian feeling of the original shows, including liberal doses of martial arts, Tai Chi, Buddhist philosophy, and Tibetan religion, even though the three protagonists are white. Its determinedly unsophisticated dialogue is pitched to resonate with parents of the New Age persuasion. Lines like, "You must let anger go," "There is no love without sacrifice," and the ever-popular, "Is there a spiritual place where I can meditate?" Speaking of truisms, it is one of Hollywood's articles of faith that if you don't hook the parents, they'll never take the kids. It will be interesting to see if The Last Airbender proves that rule or breaks it.
Kenneth Turan. He reviews movies for the Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition.
Here in Southern California, the city of Maywood is taking a drastic approach to city management. It has just fired virtually all of its public employees and outsourced all of the city's services to nearby towns. Lisa Napoli has more.
Maywood is one of the smallest of the 88 cities that make up Los Angeles County. It's just over 1 square mile and has 30,000 official residents, 45,000 if you count the undocumented immigrants who live here. That makes it one of the most densely populated cities in the United States. As of today, Maywood may have earned another distinction. City leaders say they are the first in the nation to fire all of their employees, including the police force. Now they'll pay a fee to outsource the city's municipal operations.
The contract signed with our neighboring city of Bell and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department
are in the best interest of our residents and our community.
That's Maywood Mayor Ana Rosa Rizzo announcing the changes at a news conference this week. She says contracting out operations of City Hall is the only way her hometown can continue. This working-class community isn't suffering directly because of a decline in local property taxes. What's plaguing the 86-year-old city is $12 million in lawsuits against its troubled police force. Allegations of assault and civil rights violations have led to the cancellation of the city's liability insurance and workers' compensation last month. Councilman Felipe Aguirre says outsourcing will make Maywood less of a risk and allow it to get back on financial track.
Our liability costs are going to go down tremendously, and the cost for policing the city is going to go down about 40%.
Across the country, governments and agencies typically contract out for some services. Proponents say it's more efficient and allows dollars to stretch further. But Sam Olivito of the California Contract Cities Association says he's never seen an extreme like Maywood. He says usually a city's decision to outsource for services is made over time, deliberately, and in consensus with its citizens. Olivito calls Maywood's situation draconian.
Everyone that is in public service today, public life, or as a council person, feels deeply saddened by what they have to go through. And it's a worry because it will drain our entire system if a lot of these things happen.
Olivito says outsourcing for key services can lower costs because the risk pool is greater. But the downside is that each city's unique problems can wind up being overlooked. Mayor Ana Rosa Rizzo says that doesn't seem to be a deterrent to other cities.
Our city has already been asked for our documents of joint municipal services because this is the wave of the future. We're leading the way in this kind of regionalist way of looking at things and really pooling our resources to offer the best quality services for our community.
And for now, until it can sort out its finances, Maywood feels those services are best administered from outside its borders. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Maybe it was the HBO series Big Love that helped generate a new audience for novels about polygamous life. Until now, such stories have been few and far between in mainstream publishing. Well, novelist Brady Udall will help even more. Our reviewer Alan Chu says Udall's second novel, The Lonely Polygamist, gives us the American family novel to the nth degree.
The lonely guy of the title, Golden Richards, oversees four wives and 28 children in two big houses in a remote territory of the Virgin River Valley in southwest Utah. As the novel opens, his already tentative grasp on the family reins is loosening even more, leaving him vulnerable to temptations outside his marriages and sending some of his wives and children on the path toward confusion and danger, and drawing the reader into a world of wavering belief and problematic polygamy. Simply add up the number of wives and the children in this book, and you get a cast of Dickensian proportions. Papa Golden himself has to use a mnemonic chant to recall all the names of his children. Am, Nephi, Helaman, Naomi, Josephine, it goes on and on. But though Udall mostly works in a gentle satirical tone, he feels all too deeply for Golden Richard's dilemma, which is how to enlarge your capacity to love in a world that demands that it be huge every waking and sleeping moment. The novelist's affection for his protagonist and his sensitivity to his domestic despair yields characters and scenes that are precise and unfailingly rewarding. And Udall has that gift for writing sinuous and convincing sentences that convey his affection without compromising clarity or truth. Now, marriage is a traditionally comic subject, and Udall gives us such comedy multiplied by four or five. Here's a long novel about big family and bigger love, though I can't say my attention ever flagged.
The book is The Lonely Polygamist by Brady Udall. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, a law went into effect in Virginia that seeks to exempt its citizens from the new federal health care law. In addition, the state has filed suit claiming the federal law is unconstitutional. The Obama administration was in court today to get that suit dismissed. And NPR's Julie Robner is at the courthouse in Richmond, and she joins us now. Julie, tell us what this case is all about.
Well, it's basically about what all the cases against the new law are about. It's the single most controversial feature of the new federal health care law, the so-called individual mandate that requires everyone to have health insurance starting in the year 2014. Now, Virginia was the first state to pass a law saying its citizens can't be forced to buy health insurance if they don't already have it. Its legislature did it about 2 weeks before the federal health bill became law. Now, two other states have passed similar laws, and several others are considering similar types of legislation.
So why does Virginia say this law is unconstitutional? What's the basis for that argument?
Well, the heart of its argument is that the federal government can't regulate inaction, in this case, the act of not having health insurance. While the Constitution does give the federal government the authority to regulate interstate commerce, Virginia says not having health insurance isn't commerce. And if this law is upheld, there'd be no limit to what the federal government could require people to purchase, whether it's cars or gym memberships or whatever. This is the argument that's also being made by the 20 other states that have filed suit against the health law. Virginia has a second line of argument that the other states don't, of course, and that's that their state law conflicts with the federal law that exempts Virginia residents from having to buy insurance.
And what's the federal government's response to Virginia's claims?
Well, first of all, it says the case shouldn't even be allowed to proceed. In fact, what was argued today was a preliminary motion to dismiss the case. The government says Virginia lacks standing to sue because the insurance mandate doesn't apply to the state. It applies to individual citizens. So therefore, only individual citizens have a right to sue over it. But there was also quite the discussion about the merits of the case. Basically, the Justice Department's lead attorney argued that people without insurance aren't inactive, as Virginia claims. The uninsured as a group consume an estimated $43 billion a year in medical care that doctors and hospitals write off and then pass on in higher costs to everyone else. So the insurance mandate really just requires people who currently don't have insurance to pay up front rather than to try to pay after they get sick or hit by a bus or whatever.
Did the government comment specifically on Virginia's law?
Yes, it basically said if Virginia could pass a law exempting its citizens from having to buy health insurance, then what was to stop another state from passing a law to prevent its citizens from having to register for the draft or having to pay the federal estate tax? Basically, this is what's known as a nullification law, and it has long been not allowed by the Supreme Court.
What happens next?
Well, the judge in this case, Henry Hudson, said he expected to have a written opinion on whether to allow the suit to proceed within 30 days. Meanwhile, the bigger case, the one filed by 20 state attorneys general down in Florida, is expected to have its first hearing sometime in the fall.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Michelle.
That's NPR's Julie Rovner speaking to us from Richmond, Virginia.
The recent bombing attempt in Times Square serves as a reminder of the vulnerability of U.S. cities to would-be terrorists. Author James Morrow has written an account of a terrorist bombing in New York City in 1940, and he suggests that the end result is rarely what the terrorists intend.
Our national unemployment rate is hovering around 10%. We're involved in two wars on multiple fronts, and we look to a new president who promises us hope and change. If this sounds a little familiar, it may be a good time to remember that history, as the saying goes, repeats itself. Even if those reminders include SUVs packed with explosives in Times Square. This 4th of July marks the 70th anniversary of a little-known terrorist attack on American soil. A time bomb planted in the British Pavilion at the New York World's Fair of 1939 and 1940. After it was carried to a remote area, two bomb squad detectives, Joe Lynch and Freddie Socha, tried to defuse it. The bomb went off in their faces, killing them instantly. It was a tragedy, but it could have been worse. Police Commissioner Lewis Valentine noted that it was a miracle that hundreds of fairgoers weren't killed. New York was suffering from bomb fever in those years before World War II. On September 11, 1938, two huge explosions rocked the Fir District along West 29th Street. On June 20, 1940, a pair of time bombs ripped open office buildings on Battery Place and East 12th Street. Bomb threats reached a peak of nearly 400 every week. We like to think of those days as innocent, softened by the selective memory of nostalgia, but pre-war New York City was perhaps as dangerous then as it is today when it comes to acts of terrorism. In the wake of that terrible explosion on the 4th of July in 1940, safer methods for removing and dismantling bombs were developed, saving untold lives in the process. Yet New York remains a target for terrorists looking to make a statement about global politics. The message changes, the enemies speak different languages, but for those who pack explosives into crowded tourist attractions, the modus operandi is always the same. These things invariably come back to New York, said Mayor Bloomberg in the wake of the Times Square attempt. Perhaps a hard look at history will remind us that these acts can never truly have an impact on our city or our country. The political motives behind them have lost their meaning. Their repetition across decades of perceived transgressions worldwide has taken the bite out of them. Detectives Lynch and Socha may have died saving the lives of hundreds of innocent fairgoers, but their greater sacrifice is testament to the knowledge that, in the end, the bomber's message, whatever it may be, ultimately goes undelivered.
James Morrow is the author of Twilight at the World of Tomorrow, Genius, Madness, Murder, and the 1939 World's Fair on the Brink of War. You can read an excerpt at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered.